Hello and welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later.
The choice is ours when it comes to the future of tax justice. If there is the political will, there is a bright future for tax justice.
We talk to economist Gabriel Zucman about his new book released this month, The Triumph of Injustice, How the Rich Dodge Taxes and How to Make Them Pay. But before that, we'll go straight on to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. OK, John, Extinction Rebellion has held a fortnight of protests around the world, and among their targets have been financial institutions. In London, they've targeted the Bank of England. Because if you look at the evidence, you can actually narrow down the focus on the main culprits invested in climate crisis to a really surprisingly small number of companies. I mean, there's 20 fossil fuel companies around the world responsible pretty much for carbon emissions, but they can't go on unchecked without the backing of financial institutions and investors. And it's the three investors in particular, the world's three largest money managers, have built a combined $300 billion fossil fuel investment portfolio, quite possibly using money from your pension if you have one. We could unwittingly all be investing in climate crisis without even knowing it. So how do we tackle these particular corporations? How do we target them and visibilise them, really?
Yeah, well, okay, so let's consider the global trends in the energy market, which I have to say are somewhat discouraging. So if we look at the energy market projections for the coming 30 years, and these come from the US-based Energy Information Administration, we see that despite rapid growth of renewables, demand for energy will continue to rise, industrial production will continue to grow, and the vast majority of that growth will come from fossil fuels, coal plus oil and gas. So it's a very discouraging trend, but it's not an inevitable trend. Change will only happen, however, if our governments take appropriate action, particularly governments in the massively consuming Western nations. And that means removing fossil fuel subsidies, applying carbon taxes across the board, and then it must include aviation and maritime, the big shipping companies. And that's where the big obstacles to change lie, because of the astonishing political lobbying power, not just of the big energy companies in Exxon and BP and Shell and Gazprom, but also because of the way that big financial institutions have lobbied their way and inserted their way into political processes at so many levels. And that includes the big private equity players like BlackRock, State Street and Vanguard. Now, many of these investors, I don't think many people will have heard of State Street and Vanguard. They've been able to fly below the radar of public scrutiny precisely because they're not household names at all. And they aim to keep it that way. But they've been engaging politically. They've been bringing politicians onto their board of directors. Look, for example, at George Osborne, the former finance minister in the UK. But these companies will be crucial players in deciding the future of the planet, because it's their decisions which will determine whether the bulk of investment in the energy industry in the coming decades will go into coal, oil and gas, or towards renewables. And the problem is the current balance politically is weighted towards fossil fuels, because the big industry users of energy, they find coal, oil and gas more reliable and cheaper as an energy source because of the way in which tax policies and subsidies have been geared towards those oil and gas sectors. And that's where the change is needed.
OK, yes. And even the head of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, has been warning about the dangers to capital and the dangers to investors of the climate crisis. Obviously, he's more about trying to protect capitalism from itself rather than protect people from capitalism. But he's been saying firms ignoring, and I'm quoting, firms ignoring climate crisis will go bankrupt. And he's been pointing out that US coal companies, as an example, have already lost 90% of their value. And he's said, quote, just like in any other major structural change, those banks overexposed to the sunset sectors will suffer accordingly.
Yeah, well, look, Mark Carney is not the first really important economist to signal up the need for capitalism to be protected from capitalism. Lord Keynes in the 20th century his project was all about saving capitalism from itself. Look, in a capitalist world, decisions taken by financiers are crucial, and they are crucial to solving the problem of climate crisis, because it's the financiers who will determine whether investment will continue to primarily flow into the fossil fuel industry or into renewables. So to drive decarbonisation of the global economy, we need banks and fund managers to move beyond their kind of very warm and fuzzy statements of good intention and into actually identifying the risks posed by the climate crisis to their investors. And they must also outline credible strategies for reducing the risks and protecting their shareholders and the wider community of stakeholders, which must include employees, consumers, and civil society more generally. So the banks must begin to identify the risks of their investments into fossil fuels. And Bank of England's Mark Carney, through his work with the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, he's been pushing the world banking industry to calculate the value of their exposure to climate risk and to disclose the potential losses arising from those risks to their investors. Now, this initiative was launched in 2015 by the Financial Stability Board. Mark Carney was chairing the Financial Stability Board, and it's had some support from large investors. But it's fair to say that the response from the banking community has been patchy. 76 major banks have signed up to date, and between them, they account for $59 trillion of global banking assets. So these are big players. But only 39 of those banks have even started to disclose the potential climate risk information in line with the reporting framework outlined by the task force. And some of the world's biggest banks, especially Chinese banks, haven't even signed up to this initiative. And that includes Germany's Commerzbank, a very big player in fossil fuel investment, Italy's UniCredit, another big player, and United States' Wells Fargo Bank. These banks simply haven't even signed up yet. But I'd like to see this transparency around risk exposures arising from climate crisis. I'd like to see that expanded beyond the banking and finance sector into all other sectors. Current accounting rules, for example, don't require company directors to report on climate-related risks. And let's face it, most companies have some level of risk exposure. And this needs to be understood by everyone, whether they're shareholders, employees, creditors, customers. Everyone needs to understand the risks around a company, whether it's an insurance company or a car manufacturing company or an aviation company. We all need a better understanding of the risks involved. Interestingly, in the last month, the Corporate Accountability Network, look it up on the web, has identified this area of climate risk reporting as a crucial next step in corporate accounting. And Professor Richard Murphy is heading up the development of a new financial reporting standard in this area. And we look forward to kind of see where that work takes us. So what we're moving towards, I think, is a decade where we'll see much greater disclosure by the corporate community of the risks that they've exposed themselves to on the climate crisis side.
Right, so much further to go. And what does this say about the state of capitalism now? How do we go about solving this kind of sociopathic system that we have, where you've got three big monopolies that nobody really knows about, like BlackRock, State Street and Vanguard? How do we go about pricing carbon-intensive activities into oblivion, which is what we need to do very quickly?
I think it's fair to say that capitalism is currently part of the problem rather than part of the solution, which is why the Extinction Rebellion work is so important to raise public awareness and build political pressure. You know, if we look at what capitalists have been doing in response to climate crisis evidence building up over many decades, we can see a three-pronged strategy. First, the climate change denial, which has been going on for a long time. Secondly, they've been pushing for carbon trading markets, which have allowed them to profit from trading the rights to pollute. But these markets have comprehensively failed to reduce harmful emissions. More recently, they've been advocating schemes which involve some kind of technical solution. Now, these technical solutions range from some which are relatively feasible, like carbon sequestration, technically feasible, but remarkably expensive, But at the wild and wacky end of that spectrum of technical solutions, we've heard people talking about pouring chemicals into the oceans to encourage greater carbon dioxide absorption. So yet again, capitalism's talking about a technical fix rather than a wider and more realistic political fix. If we stand back and look at the bigger picture, it's clear that the whole free market model, also known as laissez-faire capitalism, is inadequate to the task of addressing the climate crisis, precisely because free market economics totally ignores the harm caused by burning fossil fuels. And these harms aren't included in the market price, despite the fact that the harms are real and they impose real costs on people and the environment. And the trouble is that the harms don't directly impact the seller, the oil or coal company, or the buyer, the truck company operator, or the steel company, the steel manufacturers, because the contract between the buyer and the seller excludes these wider costs. Instead, the harms impact on wider communities and the environment, players who aren't directly involved in the setting of the free market price, which is why economists call these costs externalities. The costs are real, but they are external to the price-setting process. And this is a market failure that can only be effectively addressed by active intervention by the state to bring the cost of the external harms caused by burning fossil fuels into the pricing equation. And the best way of doing this is through some kind of tax on the burning of hydrocarbons. In other words, a carbon tax or a financial transaction tax, which is borne by the producers or by the investors into the fossil fuel industry. Now, as far as I'm concerned, the big advantage of this kind of approach lies with it being relatively easy to collect. Both could raise potentially huge sums, and they could both address the colossal market failure to correctly price fossil fuels. The major downside, particularly for the carbon tax, is that it is potentially highly regressive in its impact on poorer households. So unless politicians choose to design the tax in a way that compensates such households for the higher costs they will incur on transport or home heating, there's going to be a lot of public pushback, as we saw in France last year from the Gilets Jaunes, against the imposition of higher carbon taxes, precisely because it impacts worst on the poorer households.
Right, and we're seeing that being played out in Ecuador as well, with the changes the government there has made on fuel subsidies, with no thought about how that's going to affect people's daily lives. We need a big change in consciousness in terms of investing in people, societies and general well-being, rather than this constant focus on economic growth, which has led us to a disastrous path. And that really requires big government, not small government, which is going against the trend that we're seeing in the world in many places. What kind of vision can we put forward that works for people and the planet?
Right, so this opens up a crucial debate about how humankind wants to develop over the course of the coming century. In the past century, we've seen enormous expansion of material consumption in most countries across the world. But even as early as the 1960s, experts from the Club of Rome were warning, they were flagging up about the limits to growth of material consumption, and others were warning that the uneven nature of this growth was damaging social cohesion because of rising inequality and the lack of new job opportunities, particularly in the South. So we need to address the question of whether the richest 10% of the people on this planet, and especially the 50 million or so millionaires and billionaires on this planet, will be prepared to accept a reduction in their carbon footprint in order to save the planet. Because let's face it, they are the biggest source of pollution that drives climate change. The Princeton Environmental Institute in the United States has estimated that the 500 million richest people on this planet, that's roughly 7% of the total population, account for one half of total greenhouse gas emissions. They're the people we need to target. And TaxCast listeners might remember an interview you did in May 2018 with Professor Andrew Sayers, who wrote an excellent book called Why We Can't Afford the Rich. In that book, he wrote, and I quote, "Their carbon footprints are grossly inflated, and many have an interest in continued fossil fuel production, threatening the planet," end of quote. Now, just think about how President Trump flies his huge private jet up and down from New York and Washington down to Florida to play golf two or three times a week, and you'll know exactly why it's the grotesque behaviour of the very, very rich people that we need to focus on. It's not the poorest people. But this doesn't mean an end to growth. Economies can expand in less harmful ways. We could, for example, in the West, employ more teachers to teach in our schools. That would boost the economy, and it wouldn't increase carbon footprints. We could employ more nurses and care workers, and that would improve the well-being of many, many millions of people without the need to burn more fossil fuels. In other words, it's the nature of economic growth that needs to be examined rather than economic growth per se. Shifting to light urban railways, such as the system I used recently in Montpellier in France, leads to a massive improvement in the lives and the well-being of many people in the cities where they adopt light urban railways, and it leads to a much lesser use of car transport. So again, it's the nature of the growth that matters. So my vision of the 21st century is of a different kind of growth, less concentrated on the excessive consumption patterns of the richest 10% on the planet, more focused on the well-being of the remaining 90% of the people on this planet. Almost everybody would be vastly better off if we went in that direction.
Thanks, John. John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. For the first time in more than a century in the United States, billionaires are now paying lower tax rates than their secretaries. And the taxes corporations pay are plummeting as nations engage in a race to the bottom. This month, Associate Professor of Economics at Berkeley University Gabriel Zucman and co-author Emmanuel Sayers have released their new book, The Triumph of Injustice: How the Rich Dodge Taxes and How to Make Them Pay. But before we get started, here's an important point. Whenever you hear talk of proposals to tax the rich 70, 80 or 90%, that sounds a lot, but that's not on their total income. It's a top marginal tax rate that's applied over a certain agreed amount, which is always a very high amount. Back in the mid-20th century in the United States, there was a top marginal tax rate of as much as 90% for the rich, and the corporate tax rate was over 50%, believe it or not. Today, Democrats are proposing all sorts of fixes to rampant inequality, and all the decades the wealthy have been able to disproportionately accumulate their wealth as their taxes have fallen and everyone else's have risen. Just to put $1 billion into context, if you were that wealthy person and you spent $5,000 every day since that unhappy time that Christopher Columbus landed in 1492, you still wouldn't have spent $1 billion. There's many different ways of approaching wealth taxes. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has proposed a 70% marginal tax rate on income over $10 million. Bernie Sanders says billionaires shouldn't exist. Economist Thomas Piketty calls for a 90% wealth tax on the biggest fortunes. But here's Gabriel Zucman on his new book, The Triumph of Injustice.
It is a book about how we can reconcile globalization and tax justice. It is essentially very optimistic about the future, about the possibility of tax and economic and social justice in today's world. But before we express and we explain the solutions that exist, we start by explaining how tax injustice has triumphed, taking first the case of the US, but looking also more broadly all over the world. If you look at the US used to have the world's most progressive tax system, where the very rich paid 70% of their income in taxes, all taxes included, and that's an effective tax rate for the ultra-wealthy in the 1950s, and then the steel tax rates of 60% in the 1960s, early 70s. And today, so in 2018, the first year after the Trump tax reform, the ultra-wealthy have paid 23% of their income in taxes, taking into account all taxes at all levels of government, which is less than every other social group. And so the injustice is, even as they became extremely wealthy, you know, even as they benefited from globalization, from more global markets, the wealthy have seen their taxes fall dramatically, whereas in the meantime, those who've not benefited from growth, who've been shut out from economic growth, have actually seen their taxes increase. That's the injustice. And a similar process has happened in many countries, perhaps not as extreme as in the US, because the US had a very progressive tax system in the middle of the 20th century, but the same trend where the very winners from globalization see their taxes fall, while those who don't benefit or suffer from globalization see their taxes rise. This same trend can be observed in many parts of the world.
Yeah, right. And so it's really by the second half of the 20th century that we saw a lot of these really quite negative changes come in, where we saw really a victory for the low tax crusaders and the rise of the tax dodging and the wealth management industry. And it is a really shocking fact that for the first time in more than a century, billionaires are now paying lower tax rates than their secretaries. And it's really easy to forget in these times that we're living in now that it hasn't always been that way, as you say. And even the most modest proposals for reform these days seem to get shouted down for being really radical. I just wonder how you feel we ended up with such a dominant narrative like that.
So there are a number of reasons that we explain in the book. So of course you had huge ideological change and the triumph, you know, of small government, free market ideas in the 1980s, what you could call market fundamentalism. So, you know, the idea that the economy works best when government is kept as small as possible and that taxes are an obstacle to economic prosperity. This ideological change, of course, has played an important role. But the story we tell in the book goes beyond that. You know, when you look at all the episodes of decline in tax progressivity, you see a recurring pattern, which is first an outburst of tax avoidance, and then policymakers, you know, basically caught off guard saying, look, we can't tax the rich, there is all this tax dodging going on, and then eventually slashing their tax rates. So you see that, for instance, during 1980s in the US under Reagan, where before cutting the top marginal income tax rate to 28% in 1986, you have a few years of extreme tax avoidance in early 1980s, which is tolerated and in some cases even facilitated by the Reagan administration. And then 1986, they say, look, you know, the tax system is broken, we have to cut the rates. Or we see the same thing today for multinational companies. We have made a choice, not a very transparent or very democratic choice, but collectively we've chosen tax competition, one form of globalization where there's no tax coordination, there's no tax harmonization. Each country can set its own corporate income tax rate, and we make it very easy for multinational companies to shift profits to low tax places. And so the corporate tax is broken. There is more and more profit shifting to tax havens. There is more and more tax competition. And what we're seeing is governments saying, just like in the 1980s, look, it's becoming impossible to tax the multinational companies, so we have to slash the rate. And so the US cut its rate from 35 to 21% last year. The UK is in the process of cutting it to perhaps as little as 15%. France is cutting its tax rate from 33 to 25%, and so on and so on. And so the story we tell in the book is, you know, the story of this spiral, you know, why does this happen and how we can make other choices, how we can regulate the tax avoidance industry, how we can have another form of globalization where instead of tax competition, you have coordination, and instead of a race to the bottom, you have actually a race to the top.
Absolutely. It was always supposed to be companies that compete against each other, and somehow they've shifted that on off themselves and onto countries. And I think it's really such a key point as well that wealth taxes, tax justice in general, is not just about injustice, it's not just about addressing inequality levels. It's also about the fact that the economy, any economy, actually just doesn't function very well when tax rates on the rich are low and inequality is high.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you look at, you know, basic economic statistics and history, and you look at how, for instance, the US economy performed from 1950 to 1980, the average income per adult grew at a rate of 2.2% on average each year. And then since 1980, this growth rate, this macroeconomic growth rate, has basically been divided by two. to about 1.1% per year per adult. And so when the tax system was very progressive, when the top marginal income tax rate was as high as 90% as it was in the US, in the UK, in the post-war decades, when the effective corporate tax rate was very high, more than 50% for many years in many countries, including the US, then growth was also pretty strong and was, in fact, you know, the strongest episode of growth in modern history for a country like the US. And ever since tax rates have been cut to as little as 28% for the top marginal income tax rate in 1986, down from 90%, growth has actually been much less. And so, of course, you could always say, well, but maybe if tax rates had not been cut, then instead of 1.1% growth, there would have been even less growth, you know, maybe 0% or negative. But that's really a difficult argument to make. In fact, when you look at the data, what seems to be the case is that high tax rates are not detrimental, high progressive tax rates, high tax rates in the very rich are not detrimental to growth. And the reason for that is relatively simple to understand. What makes countries prosper is not exempting from taxes a tiny minority of ultra-rich individuals. It's investing in education, investing in health, investing in infrastructure, investing in all the public goods and services that make people productive and happy. And that's doable if you have a well-funded government and a government in which the people can trust, which means a government that has a fair tax system, which in turn means simply a progressive tax system.
Right, and it makes me think also of the four R's of tax, you know, the purposes of tax being revenue, redistribution, representation, and then regulation of behaviour. And I'm thinking about that in the sense of encouraging productive activities and productive investment and discouraging unproductive ones.
Yes, that was one of the reasons why countries like the US and the UK had top marginal income tax rates of 90%. For several decades, and these tax rates applied only to incomes above several millions of today's dollars. But the idea was, if you earn many, many millions, it largely corresponds at some point to rent extraction. You're getting extremely rich to a large extent at the expense of other parts of society, of other stakeholders. Maybe you are getting extremely rich by squeezing workers, by paying them very little, or maybe you're becoming extremely rich because you're enjoying monopoly positions, and so you're becoming rich at the expense of customers, or maybe you're becoming extremely rich thanks to the appropriation of public and common resources. In that case, you're becoming rich at the expense of the rest of society as a whole. But that has always been the main reason, the main rationale behind this idea of that there should be quasi-confiscatory top marginal income tax rates for very, very high incomes. And so the point is not to have 90% top tax rates, you know, for on the upper middle class or, you know, the merely rich, but in the English and American progressive tradition, there is this idea that the tax system plays a key role to limit rent extraction, to curb the forms of rent extraction that are associated with completely unfettered markets. That's very important.
Let's talk about the historical database that you created for the book, which tracks the tax payments of households at different points along the income spectrum, going back to 1913 in the United States when the federal income tax began. Why did you do that, and what did you expect to find there?
We wanted to know what's been the effective tax rate paid by the very rich, because we all know that on paper, the US tax system, like the UK tax system, looked extremely progressive in the middle of the 20th century, with top marginal income tax rates of 90%, top estate tax rates of close to 80%, with high corporate tax rates. And so we all know that. And the question was, okay, what was effectively paid? Is it the case that there was a lot of tax avoidance and that these rates were never really applied, and that the US never truly managed to tax the rich? So there is this view, which is very strong in the US, that the US really has never, in actual facts, tax the rich. It has pretended to do so with this nominally progressive tax system, but it has never done that in practice. And so we wanted to study whether that view is true or not. And what we found is that this view is wrong. That is, when you compute effective tax rates, taking into account all taxes, you find very high tax rates of 60 up to 70% for the super rich in the middle of the 20th century. And so that was really, you know, a time when the US made a serious attempt not only at regulating the market economy and inequality through the tax system, but also at collecting a vast amount of revenue from the extremely rich. And we were surprised to some extent because this view that there was a ton of tax avoidance when the top marginal income tax rates were high and so nobody paid high taxes is so mainstream that, you know, we did not know exactly what we would find, but what we found is that in particular because the corporate income tax rate was so high and because corporate equities mostly belong to very wealthy individuals, in effect, total effective tax rates for the truly rich were high in the middle of 20th century.
Let's talk about the proposals that you make for rewriting the tax code. You make many proposals, but one of them would be the overall tax rate on the richest 1%, and you estimate that would bring in about $750 billion a year. Tell me a bit about that.
What we're asking is a simple question, which is, if you want to maximize the amount of tax revenue that you could collect from the rich, let's say from the top 1%, what tax rate should you apply? And of course, if you tax the rich, you know, more, there's going to be some what economists call behavioral responses to taxation. And so maybe they're going to work a bit less, and so maybe they're going to report a bit less income. But when you take that into account on the basis of the many studies that exist, what you find is that the optimal average tax rate on the top 1%, meaning the one that maximizes government revenue, well, the tax rate that reaches the top of the Laffer curve, for the rich is about 60%. Okay, and that corresponds to a marginal tax rate of 75% in the context of the US, let's say 75% above $500,000 in income. And all included, you know, dividing total tax payments by total income, that corresponds to an average tax rate for the top 1% of 60%. And so then we explain, okay, so that if you want to make the rich pay, and it's not a goal in itself, but it's useful if you want to fund health insurance, childcare, education, all the things that make societies as a whole prosperous. If you want to make the rich pay, you should aim for 60%. And then there are many ways to reach that objective. And traditionally, when some countries had very progressive tax system, the corporate tax played a key role, and we think it should still play an important role in the 21st century. But it's not enough to reach 60% to make the, in particular, billionaires pay sizable taxes. You need a wealth tax, and so we explain, you know, why a progressive tax on net wealth is the most powerful and direct, and in fact, almost the only way to make the ultra wealthy, to make billionaires pay sizable amounts. And so we discuss a lot in the book how a wealth tax, a tax on the super rich, a tax on extreme wealth, could be made to work really well given, you know, modern technology, given the information that exists in tax authorities, given all we know about how to make taxes work.
Right. And the first thing that those that would criticize this would say is, well, the rich will just move their money. They'll take it offshore even more than they already do, and they will benefit from what is actually very cheap privacy for them. Not a good enough reason, in my view, not to try to do this, but what would you respond to that?
Yeah, my response is, look, tax evasion, tax avoidance are not laws of nature. These are policy choices. So governments choose to tolerate or to forbid tax avoidance and tax evasion. We can choose to allow secrecy. We can choose to have a lightly or not regulated tax avoidance industry. We can choose a form of globalization with tax competition, with no harmonization, with not enough transparency on wealth, Or we can make other choices. We can choose to record wealth in registries. We can choose to regulate the tax avoidance industry. We can choose another form of globalization where instead of signing free trade agreements that don't talk about taxation at all, we make tax cooperation and tax harmonization and tax coordination a vital and a prerequisite part of international economic coordination, cooperation, and of free trade agreements. So the choice really belongs to us. The choice belongs to governments. And historically, different choices have been made. If you look at the New Deal era tax system in the US, that was a choice to enforce the spirit of the law, to reduce tax avoidance to a minimum. And that's the reason why effective tax rates remain so high for many decades in the US during the 20th century. Since the 1980s, another choice has been made. There's been a choice to tolerate tax dodging along many dimensions. But maybe, and that's my feeling, we're at the beginning of a new era where we are again going to make other choices and we're going to say, no, this time we make the choice of not tolerating tax avoidance and evasion.
I hope so. Let's talk about the minimum global corporate tax rate. You're talking about a minimum global corporate tax rate of at least 25%.
So the idea is to make sure that multinational companies pay at least 25% in taxes in each of the countries where they book profits. And so the way to do that is actually pretty simple. If you take, for instance, the US, and you look at US multinationals, so companies incorporated, headquartered in the US, let's say Apple. The US government could say, if Apple pays only a 1% tax rate on the profits they book in Ireland, we are going to collect the missing 24%. There's a tax deficit, if you want. They should pay 25% in each of the countries where they operate. In some countries, they pay less than 25%. And we are going to collect that tax deficit. For U.S. headquartered multinationals, the U.S. would collect 100% of the tax deficit and, in effect, enforce a 25% country-by-country minimum tax rate, no matter what tax havens choose. That is, in that system, even if Ireland chooses a 1% or 5% tax rate, the U.S. would collect the difference in such a way that it would be pointless for companies like Apple to book profits in Ireland. And then what you can do is you can apply a similar system for foreign companies. So taking again the example of the US, let's say you have BMW, a German company, that books profits in tax havens, and let's say that it has a tax deficit, perhaps because it books profits again in, let's say, the Cayman Islands, where the profits are taxed at 0%, you can compute what's the tax deficit of BMW by saying, here is how much more BMW should pay if all of its profits in each country were taxed at a rate of 25%. The difference between that and what they currently pay is the tax deficit of BMW. And then the US, let's say, in my example, could say, well, if BMW makes 20% of its sales in the US, we, the US, are going to collect 20%, in my example, of BMW's global tax deficit. So to summarize, for US corporations, the US would collect 100% of the tax deficit. For foreign corporations, they would collect the fraction of their tax deficit that corresponds to the fraction of their global sales that they make in the US. And I took the US as one example, but any country could apply such a system on its own. Take the UK, you take Germany, you take India, you take Brazil. Any country could say, we are going to police our own multinationals. If they don't pay enough abroad, we're going to collect the difference. And if foreign corporations don't pay enough abroad and have sales and have activities in our country, we're going also to collect part of their tax deficit. So that's the idea.
Okay, and there's various ideas about how to put into action unitary taxation with formulary apportionment. The OECD supports the sales-based formula, and there's a lot of debate about it, and lots of people argue that if you include employment in that formula in working these things out, it will do a lot to help ensure fairer taxing rights for lower-income countries. What do you think about that?
I think this debate is slightly misplaced in the sense that we are spending too much time talking about technical details like formulas or tweaks to arm's length pricing, and we are not spending enough time talking about tax rates. But tax rates is what matters, because even if we find the perfect formula, even if we found the perfect way to allocate taxing rights across countries, even if we found the perfect fix to the current international tax system, if the tax rates keep falling, and they're falling very fast, the average global corporate tax rate statutory was 48% in the mid-1980s. Now it's less than 24%. So it has fallen by half over the course of three decades. And if this continues, it will go to zero over the course of the next three decades. So even if we find a way to define the perfect tax base, but at the end of the day, we apply tax rates of 10%, 5%, 1%, or 0% to this perfect tax base, that's pointless. You know, that's a huge waste of time. And that's, in my view, the main limitation of the OECD approach, which never talks about tax rates. We must talk about tax rates. We must enforce a minimum country-by-country tax rate of 25%. And if, you know, it's always better if there is international cooperation, but even countries individually can do that, can enforce minimum country-by-country tax rates of 25% by policing their own multinationals and by making foreign multinationals pay to the extent that they don't pay enough abroad. I think that's the discussion we need to have at this stage.
Okay, so much of the problem is that we need to identify all the assets and the wealth that is out there, and because there is so much that is hidden. And that is the idea behind work towards a global asset registry. I know this is quite a new thing. Can you tell me a little bit about that idea of a global asset registry and how that might help?
Yeah, and the idea is today there is considerable opacity about who owns what. And we have land and real estate registries, which are imperfect, but they've been there for a long time, sometimes for centuries. When they were created centuries ago, they recorded, in effect, most or even all of people's wealth, because most wealth was in land and real estate. But now what has happened is that a big fraction of household wealth is not land or real estate, it's financial assets, equities, bonds, mutual fund shares, and we're not making any attempt at recording those assets. And my idea is simply to extend the registries, the land and real estate registries that exist today, to financial assets. You know, the goal is to be able to better enforce taxes. And if you want to tax wealth, you need to measure wealth, you need to collect the information that will then feed pre-populated wealth tax returns, for instance, but also to fight corruption and money laundering and plutocracy. And so you can see that as a kind of a global public good. You know, with ownership comes, you know, some certain rights, but also duties. You know, it's impossible to have ownership with rights only and no duty. And the basic duty is to pay taxes and to respect the law. So as a price to pay for owning, you know, property, for owning wealth, property ownership should be recorded in global asset registries. That's the idea. When it comes to the future of taxation and tax progressivity in particular, everything is possible. Many people have become convinced that with globalization and modern technology, it has become very hard or impossible to tax the rich, to tax big multinational companies. And what we want to say is that this view is wrong. The choice is ours. When it comes to the future of tax justice, if there is the political will, there is a bright future for tax justice.
You've been listening to Gabriel Zucman on the TaxCast. His book is called The Triumph of Injustice: How the Rich Dodge Taxes and How to Make Them Pay. It's published by W.W. Norton & Co. Try not to buy it from a monopolistic tax-dodging multinational like Amazon. That's it for now. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.